Hi, everybody. Glad you're here. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS, and I am I'm standing in today. Charles Freeman, who had helped arrange to bring David here, is unfortunately away because of a death in the family, and so Charles asked if I would step in and just introduce Undersecretary McCormick, and I said I'd be delighted to do that. I've been an admirer of David McCormick now for 5-6 years. We first met when David was over at the Commerce Department, and he was managing the export policy side of commerce, and it's a thankless job, I will say. But he did exceptionally well, and then was, of course, tapped to go to the White House, where he was the Deputy National Security Advisor for International Economic Affairs, and did such a good job that he's been tapped yet again and is now at Treasury, where he is the Undersecretary, you know, for International Affairs at Treasury. And a remarkably gifted individual. I rather resent someone younger than me who is so much more capable, I guess, but I have to get used to that now. I'm on that side of life's history, I guess. He has a Ph.D. from the Woodrow Wilson School. I became quite interested in talking with David because he was a West Point grad and served in Desert Storm, you know, as an infantry officer. We were joking about his young assistant here who wants to become a Marine, and we said we can't figure out why he would not want to be a fighting man instead. He could be an Army Ranger, so part of the standard, very healthy rivalry that we have. We're very fortunate that Undersecretary McCormick can join us today. This is part of a series that we have been sponsoring under a general umbrella of what we call smart power, and that is that our view that America has been relying a little too much on our military muscle in recent years, and that there's so much wider portfolio of resources and tools that is available to us that really amplifies the reach and the influence of this country. I personally believe probably nothing is greater in that regard than is America's economic involvement in the world. And are we a smart and wise economic player? It's coming at a time when, frankly, Americans are very conflicted on economics. We've got half of the country is afraid of imports and half of the country is afraid of immigrants. We're afraid of things outside. And yet when you think about the prosperity that's been propelling this country and the world forward over the last 10 years, it has been hugely a product of the way in which we've embraced the challenges of international trade. And yet, politically, we're afraid of it. And that's the interesting dynamic that we're now looking at with this election. Now, Undersecretary McCormick is going to share with us, I think, the insights, the rich insights of a man who's now been deeply involved in this, the process of policy formulation to make us a smart international economic power, and hopefully identify the product and the new approach that we can transition to the next administration, whoever that is. We don't want to lose the innovation and the energy that he's been investing in this country's economic policies, trade policies. And so it's really in that spirit, David, we welcome you. We're delighted you're here. It's going to be a fascinating afternoon. Thank you all for coming. He will speak maybe for 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll take questions. And I will tell you, it's your obligation to make this a good session. I mean, the quality of these meetings rests very much on your involvement, and so I encourage you to press him hard. He's up to it. David McCormick, thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for being here. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you all very much for being here. For those of you that were planning to attend this a couple weeks ago when I canceled unexpectedly, I appreciate you bearing with me. As I sat back and thought about what I might speak about today, it was actually hard to get out of the present and think a little bit more reflectively about some of the challenges we face, because there's obviously a lot going on in the world today. A lot going on in our global economy, a lot going on in the U.S. economy. But one of the things that has occurred to me as I've been in several of the jobs that John mentioned is just how much our government and our policy, and in particular where I now sit, the Treasury Department, has evolved. Its mission, has evolved the way it operates to accommodate some of these challenges. So what I'd like to do today is kind of lay out some of the changes in the world and how we've tried to respond to those, and then perhaps some areas that we're going to need to think about in the future. Today's global and international financial system is characterized by increasingly interconnected financial markets and expanding cross-border flows. And while these bring enormous benefits and enormous efficiencies to our economy and to the global economy, this also makes our economy more vulnerable to risk or disruptions that exist or could arise in far-off places around the world. In today's environment, we are also uniquely challenged with protecting our national security by countering new threats that exist from illicit finance or threats that will come to be if we don't rebuild fragile security environments, which are of paramount concern. In addition, we have a whole new set of global public good challenges, such as addressing climate change or the rises in commodity prices that have taken on important economic implications, and just in the last few months, in the case of commodity prices, increasing urgency. Simply put, we face challenges today that are more complex, more diverse, and more interdependent than those of the past. And not surprisingly, to be effective in this changing environment, the Treasury Department has had to make some pretty dramatic changes in how we define our mission and how we are organized to achieve it. We've had to develop new capabilities at home and abroad to address these challenges. Treasury's core mission has typically been focused on supporting the integrity and strength of financial markets and promoting U.S. growth and global growth and economic stability. And in recent months, that traditional role of responding to crises and supporting global financial stability has been underscored by the rapid and comprehensive policy response that's been required to ensure that our current financial markets are stable and this turmoil that we see ultimately becomes a thing of the past. But Treasury has also developed and deployed new capabilities in other critical areas. And these capabilities have been focused on combating illicit finance and ensuring economic renewal in post-conflict countries, in fighting protectionism, and in supporting and, where appropriate, leading multilateral efforts to protect the environment in tandem with sustainable economic growth. In short, today's Treasury is very, very different than the one that existed 7.5 years ago. It's different substantially from the one that existed even 2 years ago when Secretary Paulson joined the administration. And while there's certainly a great deal more to be done, we are well prepared, I think, to develop and execute U.S. economic policy in these challenging times. Now, at the center of our current efforts, at the center of our focus, is maintaining the health and the stability of the U.S. economy. And the U.S. economy, as you all know, is facing significant headwinds. Sharp reductions in the housing sector, financial market turmoil, and rapidly rising energy prices. Though these challenges are serious, and we expect to be working through them for some time, the long-term prospects of the U.S. economy and the fundamentals on which the U.S. economy is based remain sound. Policymakers in the United States and around the world are taking aggressive and targeted actions to stabilize the financial markets, reduce the impact of what we see in the financial markets and housing on the U.S. economy, and importantly, to protect against the same mistakes from being repeated. The highest priority that you've probably heard Secretary Paulson and the President and others talk about has been addressing the challenges resulting from this turmoil to reduce the impact on the real economy. The administration and Congress responded with a $150 billion bipartisan stimulus package when it became clear that what we were experiencing really did pose a risk to the U.S. economy. We also launched a series of housing market initiatives to help millions of Americans prevent avoidable foreclosures. There's also been a focus on enhanced domestic regulatory coordination. This has been a key part of the response. In the United States, the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, which is chaired by Secretary Paulson, has reviewed the causes of the recent turmoil, and we've made recommendations to mitigate systemic risk, restore investor confidence, and facilitate stable economic growth. And these recommendations, although we're in many ways 6 months into this, are already being implemented. International regulatory coordination has also been a priority. Today's global markets require an international response, And this is necessary to guard against an uneven implementation of regulations or regulatory arbitrage. And therefore, we've worked closely with our counterparts in other major economies around the world to address this market instability in a way that's consistent and comprehensive. The Financial Stability Forum, which brings together the supervisors, the central banks, and the finance ministries of all the major financial centers, has been critical to this effort. And this body, the FSF, has released a number of recommendations that echo and are consistent with the efforts of the President's working group that are already underway in the United States. So there's been a very significant and a very comprehensive regulatory response. And while if you pointed to any one of the 60 or so changes that have been made, they might not seem significant in isolation, but together they represent a very significant and robust shift in regulatory response. But beyond these near-term actions, there's also been a need to ensure that we periodically assess our financial system to ensure that it's effective and that it's kept up with changes in the world. And it's for this reason that before the financial market turmoil began last summer, that the Treasury began to consider how to regulate and how to update our outmoded regulatory structure. The recently released blueprint for a modernized financial regulatory structure proposes an objectives-based approach consisting of three regulators: a market stability regulator, a prudential regulator for institutions with federal guarantees, and a business conduct regulator with a focus on consumer protection. And we see this combination of initiatives, all those that I've mentioned, already beginning to have a positive effect. As with other periods of market instability, this storm too shall pass. And the United States will work through these challenges and emerge, as it has in the past, as a driver of innovation and economic growth within the global economy. Now, these efforts, all the things I've described, while so critical, should be of no surprise. These are at the center of Treasury's longstanding mandate to ensure financial market stability. What some of you may not know, however, are the other critical efforts underway over the past year that are reflective of Treasury's changing role in a globalized world. A relatively new but important area of Treasury involvement in national security is combating illicit financial activity. To manage the threat to the international financial system, Treasury has built up its capabilities to target state sponsors of terror and to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We have also coupled these domestic actions with a whole set of multilateral efforts and actual engagement with the international financial community, with the banks, with the institutions, to increase the effectiveness of our work. Within Treasury, the administration has created a new office, the Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, led by an undersecretary and dedicated to targeting financial networks supporting illicit actors. And this includes narcotics traffickers and terrorist groups. This office was at the beginning of a transformation within the Treasury to play a more strategic role in combating terrorism post 9/11. We've also created an in-house intelligence analysis office to bring the knowledge of the intelligence community to bear in the efforts to combat the threat of illicit finance. Iran's a case in point. We have seen that a combination of targeted financial measures can put real pressure on the regime and its continued pursuit of nuclear capability and its support for terrorist groups. Diplomatic efforts have resulted in 3 UN Security Council resolutions that target the entities and individuals that support Iran's attempt to develop WMD. Treasury is working to implement these resolutions and prevent illicit conduct through targeted financial measures. And these measures are focused on banks, Iranian banks, entities, and individuals that are engaged in the activities that I mentioned. We're also coordinating international efforts to alert the international financial community on the threats of money laundering and terrorist financing. There's an enormous reputational risk for these global financial institutions of being associated with these activities. In February of 2008, the world's premier standard-setting body on countering the financing of terrorism, the Financial Action Task Force, called on all governments to issue advisories to their financial institutions, warning them of the risk of dealing with Iran. And all 32 member countries and all the jurisdictions have responded by issuing these warnings. And on June 23rd, the European Union designated and froze the assets of Iran's largest state-owned bank, Bank Mellie. The bottom line is that these efforts are making a difference. Earlier this year, Ali Larijani, who serves as Iran's top nuclear negotiator, said, "These sanctions are a burden on our economy. Rising inflation, a rising unemployment rate, and the high cost of living are all direct consequences of the sanctions. We have learned at the Treasury that sanctions, especially targeted ones, will always be more effective when done on a multilateral basis, and what we're doing now is really having an impact. Another facet of Treasury's role in national security can be seen in our work supporting the development of economies in difficult security environments. Through our experiences in war-torn countries like the Balkans, the Middle East, and Africa, the United States has learned that security and economic stability must go hand in hand if we are to achieve lasting peace. Treasury's role is to devise and implement strategies that avert financial crises and to promote policies that generate sustainable growth and job creation. To do this right, we have to put people in the field, both financial attachés and technical advisors. In fact, we've had some of the first civilians on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as places like Kosovo and Bosnia and Liberia. These critical personnel assess the situation on the ground, and they help us respond with appropriate measures. Treasury's played a major role, for example, in helping the government of Iraq create a more stable macroeconomic environment and build a solid foundation for economic growth. Following the fall of Saddam Hussein, our advisors alerted us that there was rampant counterfeiting that could lead to the collapse of the value of the currency and feed unrest and inflation. Under the leadership of one of my predecessors, John Taylor, they then developed a comprehensive plan for creating, printing, and circulating a new currency to over 250 distribution points around the world, around the country. Currently, we are working with the military to help Iraq use its resources more effectively to ensure that essential services like electricity get to the people. And because these efforts are so important to preserving recent security gains, we are planning to more than double our existing presence in the next few months. This plan is closely coordinated with the military that provides us security. And General Petraeus has told me personally that he views the deployment of these Treasury advisors as one of his top priorities. We are making similar contributions in Afghanistan, where our advisors helped the Afghan Ministry of Finance craft the first post-Taliban budget, working with nothing more than an Excel spreadsheet. And our debt management experts have helped Afghanistan secure over $10 billion in international debt relief and build the capacity to avoid falling back into unsustainable debt. Without progress in these areas, Afghanistan has little hope of achieving a lasting and economically viable peace. And we know that by helping these countries govern effectively and achieving economic success, their citizens will develop a stake in political stability. And by doing so, they'll eliminate the longer-term need for boots on the ground. A fourth area posing new challenges and new responsibilities is the growing risk of protectionism, particularly directed towards foreign investment, including investment from sovereign wealth funds here in the United States. In the aftermath of 9/11, we have seen a backlash against foreign investment on national security grounds, with some voicing concerns about the potential for foreigners to gain control over key sectors or critical technologies within our borders. Foreign control over U.S. businesses may, in some cases, raise national security concerns. But we also know that foreign direct investment flows in the United States strengthen our economy by stimulating jobs and creating growth. U.S. affiliates of foreign multinationals employ over 5 million U.S. workers, about 4.5% of all private sector employment. And these foreign firms pay on average 25% more than U.S. firms, and they help stimulate investment in research and development in high technology areas that promote innovation and competitiveness. Thus, a significant component of our economic policy mission is to safeguard national security, but in a way that maintains and strengthens the U.S. economy through our long-standing commitment to an open investment policy. Recent proposals in other countries for adding restraints on foreign investment raise concerns in this regard. Investment reviews must be strictly limited to genuine national security concerns, not broader economic or political concerns. In the United States, the Interagency Committee on Foreign Investment, which is chaired by Secretary Paulson, reviews certain foreign investments in U.S. businesses to determine whether they raise legitimate national security concerns. The preponderance of transactions in the United States do not, and therefore they do not require a CFIUS review. For the cases that do, we are taking steps to clarify and streamline this process consistent with an open investment mindset and an open investment philosophy. Foreign government-controlled investment particularly from sovereign wealth funds, has also garnered a great deal of attention recently. The rapid growth in the number and size of sovereign wealth funds does raise legitimate financial stability and investment policy questions, but these should be addressed through a measured multilateral approach that maintains openness. Treasury has taken a number of steps to help accomplish this, including proposing and strongly supporting efforts by the IMF to develop voluntary best practices for sovereign wealth funds, as well as an initiative underway at the OECD to develop best practices for countries that receive sovereign wealth fund investment. Both of these efforts expect to release their reports and their recommendations in the fall of this year, and that will be an important step towards ensuring we maintain openness and transparency on both sides of the investment equation. A final area of interest and a final area of work is the efforts that Treasury has undertaken in the area of environmental and energy policy, an area that's largely been ignored by finance ministries up until now. This is part of Treasury's portfolio where our interactions with the emerging economies are particularly important. Since 2002, developing countries have been responsible for about two-thirds of global GDP growth. And not surprisingly, the environmental implications of their exploding energy needs are daunting. While this unprecedented expansion has brought economic opportunities and higher standards of living to these what in many cases were previously impoverished countries, it has also led to a surging demand for power, transport, building, and industrial sectors. The International Energy Agency estimates that last year China surpassed the United States as the largest global greenhouse gas emitter, and the rate of emissions growth in the developing countries will soon surpass those of developed countries. The need for sustainable economic growth, but in a way that protects our planet, is one of the most pressing challenges facing our country. Now, recognizing this fact, President Bush has asked Secretary Paulson in September of 2007 to take the lead in establishing a major multilateral initiative to create an international clean technology fund to help developing countries harness the power of clean energy technologies to put themselves on a cleaner emissions growth trajectory. The Clean Technology Fund, which is to be housed at the World Bank, aims to reduce the growth of greenhouse gas emissions in developing countries by helping to finance the additional cost of deploying the cleanest available commercial technology. This will stimulate and leverage private sector investment in existing clean technologies, and it will promote international trust and cooperation on climate change. And this is a prerequisite for any future climate change agreement. Secretary Paulson has led U.S. efforts to build support for the development of this fund in conjunction with the United Kingdom and Japan, the other founding partners. Earlier this month, the G8 finance ministers issued a strong statement endorsing the fund and calling on others to participate. And this week, G8 countries collectively pledged over $5 billion for the Clean Technology Fund. This fund is one very important step that the United States can take, along with other developed countries, to demonstrate leadership and to contribute constructively to broader international efforts to mitigate the effects of climate change. Clearly, climate change will have lasting economic effects, as will the policies that are developed to address it. Treasury must play a critical role in policy development and implementation. And as a result, we have created a new senior position and a dedicated team specifically for providing leadership on international and domestic economic policy issues related to the environment. Now, ladies and gentlemen, today I have focused on the U.S. Treasury's role in the global economy and the way we have adopted to meet these new challenges. But we're not alone in needing reform. There is also a pressing need to evolve among other finance ministries, central banks, regulators, the International Monetary Fund, and the multilateral development banks around the world. There are a few areas in particular that deserve a brief mention. First, the coordination and cooperation on international economic policy can no longer be isolated to the G7 countries alone. As dynamic emerging economies increase their share of and integration into the global economy, our existing dialogues, such as the G7 and the G8, the G20, and the Financial Stability Forum, and others, they must adapt to accommodate the increasingly important role played by these countries. Likewise, the international financial institutions, such as the IMF, must also reform in order to remain relevant. The IMF has taken an important first step to reform its governance structure to reflect the growing weight of dynamic emerging markets. They reformed the quota and voice representation of their members. But it needs to evolve further by strengthening its multilateral and bilateral surveillance capabilities, focusing on exercising firm exchange rate surveillance, encouraging openness to international investment, and supporting global financial market stability. For the multilateral development banks, this means considering how to effectively address their core missions to promote economic development and reduce poverty. They should also consider how to work more effectively within their comparative advantages vis-a-vis the donor community and how to leverage their unique convening ability to tackle serious problems of public goods, such as climate change, HIV/AIDS, and escalating food prices in a coordinating way. We see as an example the World Bank, under Bob Zelick's leadership, making important strides in this direction. As the world's transformed around us, Treasury has had to think its role, had to rethink its role in the global economy and the ways that we fulfill our mission. Even as many of our longer-term goals and priorities, such as ensuring stable growth and maintaining global financial stability, have not changed, the way we do business to achieve them has. The challenges I discussed today are just a few examples of the many we face. In these rapidly changing times, economic policymakers around the world must continuously review and adapt how they are defining and conducting their missions. While our journey is far from complete, we at the U.S. Treasury Department have made important progress on this front. Thank you. Sure.
We're going to take some questions. I'm Carol Emma Gifford, a vice president here at CSIS, and if it's okay, I think I'll take the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question. Another one of the new roles that Treasury has taken in the last few years, especially since Secretary Paulson took office, is the taking the lead on China. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the U.S.-China senior economic dialogue and what you see as its future going into the next administration.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So the strategic economic dialogue was conceived with the idea that we really needed to create a structured way to interact at the highest levels of the Chinese government and the United States government on the broader economic agenda. And it began with the recognition that some of these opportunities and challenges that we have in our economic relationship are significant and structural, and as such require sort of an ongoing, continuous, and focused dialogue on finding areas which are in the interest of both of our countries in terms of reform and moving forward. So the dialogue was conceived 4 meetings ago, almost 2 years ago, and we've just had most recently our 4th meeting. The focus has been primarily on economic reform, financial services liberalization. There's been a food and product safety dimension to it, energy and the environment. And these are areas where we've tried to structure a dialogue where we could find areas of common interest and make the case to the Chinese that the reforms that we're talking about are very much in their interest as well as our interest. And I think we've seen some real progress on that front. It's certainly an area where we've brought together the right people on both sides, and the Chinese view it as very constructive and positive. We do as well. There's a whole series of things that have resulted from that. I think that our expectation and hope is that this will continue in the next administration. I don't know what it'll be called and who all the participants will be, but it's hard to argue with the benefit of a dialogue that does, in fact, operate at that level, finds areas of common interest, and makes tangible progress on that front. So we're trying to structure it in a way that it can continue on. And many of the goals and many of the areas of focus are such that they're not going to be resolved in 6 months. They really do need to have multi-month, multi-meeting, multi-year focus and effort against them. Thank you.
I'm going to open it up to the audience. If you could please state your name and your affiliation, sir.
Well, in the case of the first stimulus package, there has been a remarkable effort to really accelerate that. It was, as you know, a very rapid bipartisan consensus, a stimulus package passed by the Congress, signed by the President. And those checks have largely gone out the door already. I think the last statistics I saw suggested that of the $100 billion, at least $88 or $90 billion had already made its way into the public's hands. And we're starting to see that show up in the consumption numbers, which is a good thing. And there's a whole series of initiatives that are underway to try to help the economy work its way through these challenging times. At this time, there's no contemplation of an additional second stimulus package.
I'm Howard Wiarda from CSIS and a foreign policy analyst here. I have to tell you, I'm so happy that you're doing this because it sounds like your office has introduced a real international affairs agenda into Treasury. If I could just tell you a brief story, which may be of interest in the rest of the room. 20 years ago, I wrote on third world debt issues, and on the basis of that was invited over to Treasury to give a talk, and on the basis of that was offered a job at Treasury until they found out I was a political scientist rather than an economics guy. And they said, oh, we can't have political scientists in the Treasury Department because they deal with politics and we divorce ourselves from politics. So I'm so happy to hear of your agenda because it looks like you're dealing with serious political economy issues and not just one side of the agenda. So I wonder if you might comment on the degree to which Treasury has become interested in international politics and security. And my guess is it must be from your own background and appointment to this position. And maybe from the point of view of the interns in the room, you might comment as to whether that means there's now room for international affairs majors and political scientists at the Treasury Department. Quick second question, if I can. I wonder if you might briefly comment about how you see your office and Treasury going on into the future. That is, we have been so preoccupied with international terrorism and security issues the last few years as compared with the Clinton era when it was almost all international economic policy. I wonder if, as Iraq winds down and the American economy is in some trouble and oil markets, if you see international economic issues as again becoming more dominant as compared with diplomatic and political and strategic. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, in terms of the agenda, what I tried to describe was not just solely my area, but it's the broader Treasury international agenda, so it includes some of the terrorist financing and other things that don't fall in my particular area. And, you know, probably a wise thing to say, but in this case it's actually true. It's not my agenda, it's the Secretary's. And he has, I think, not an orientation towards political issues. He's not in the politics business or the economics business. He's in the results business. And if you think about Iraq and some of the economic challenges on the ground there, you need to help that country find its way to a stable economic environment if ultimately the longer-term national objectives are going to be met. The same holds true with climate change and the energy issues. So that's not traditionally been an area where the Treasury spent a whole lot of time. But if you think about the top three economic challenges that policymakers over the next two decades will face, I think if we took a poll in this room, most of you would say that energy and the environment are going to be in the top three list. They may be in the number one in many of our lists. So for the primary economic policymakers, the primary economic policy cabinet member, the Secretary of Treasury, to be deep on those issues is just a necessity in this changing world we live in. And so I think that agenda that I described, while certainly not the only part of the Treasury agenda, reflects that recognition and some of the dynamics we see in the world today. Within the Treasury Department, you know, it's a real pleasure to be there. I've been in three different places in the U.S. government. All of them are filled with capable, dedicated people. But I've got a special respect for what we have in the Treasury because it's a very technical, very bright and very focused group. And, you know, you routinely come across people that have been in their respective areas for 10, 15, 20 years and bring the same energy and enthusiasm that they probably had in the first couple years matched with all sorts of depth and experience because they've been through this before. And so it's a very talented group, and there's a mix there of both people with economic backgrounds as well as people with less than hardcore economics backgrounds. I think there's a place for a mix of those people in the Treasury. In terms of the next administration, you know, one of the benefits, I think, of the Treasury Department is I don't think most of the people think of it, nor do we necessarily think of the agenda is unique to this administration or the next administration. And by that I mean many of these issues transcend party, and they are very critical priorities for the country going forward. So how we work our way through the current financial market challenges, how we deal with the commodity prices that we see, how we work in some of these post-conflict situations, that will be the brief that lands on the desk of the next Treasury Secretary, and I'm hopeful that they'll view these problems as the same way we've tried to, which is significant, intractable, and ones that really deserve and require a new way of thinking about this and a real focus and resources on the part of the Treasury Secretary.
Certainly is in the front line when it comes to terrorist issues, and also is in a deepening crisis economically, both because of food and fuel prices, but also because there is virtually no foreign investment, especially Western investment, in that country. And what you at Treasury and State and elsewhere feel needs to be done to improve the environment in Pakistan for foreign investors who have watched that country really not get its act together from the point of view of contract disputes and other enforcement of international arbitration awards and these matters.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that question. I'm afraid I'm not going to have a very in-depth or maybe that useful of an answer because it's a very challenging situation. As you know, the political instability, the security environment, some of the underlying economic challenges that have been there for some time that are only exacerbated by the challenges in the political environment and the security environment make it a particularly difficult situation. The economy is highly dependent on foreign assistance, as you know, and because of the things you highlighted, the foreign investment has not been strong and has weakened as a consequence of legitimate concerns from foreign investors. And I think it's one of those situations where until there's a greater degree of political stability and an improvement in the security environment, it's going to be very hard to create the kind of business environment. And this is a story of incrementalism. If you use just as an example, Iraq, certainly I don't think anyone would point to the investment environment in Iraq is perfect at this point. But there's been a steady improvement, an incremental improvement in political stability, political consensus, far from where we'd like it to be, but significant. There's been a notable and significant improvement in the security environment. And as each little step has been made in those areas, you've seen cautious movements in the area of foreign investment to the point now where I think we're on the verge of seeing significant inflows of foreign capital into Iraq. And so there's no big bang. Unfortunately, in the case of Pakistan, which I know you know well, but it's going to require some improvement in those other two dimensions, I think, until the economic environment is going to be more conducive. And it's an area we're very focused on, an area where I know some of the multilateral institutions are very focused on, and it's something that I think you're right needs to even probably raise a little bit higher on the priority list.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Stephen Canna with the U.S. Council for International Business, and thank you for coming here today. I have a question that doesn't necessarily reflect the view of our members, but one which is a great curiosity to me in the area of stability of financial markets. It's the accounting practice of marking assets to market. And a Treasury alumnus, Peter Wallison, former general counsel, now at AEI, has written extensively, and I tend to agree with him, that this practice of marking to market is pro-cyclical, and it aggravates the problem on the downside and on the upside. And yet the SEC says in times of distressed markets, basically, you're on your own, fellas. I mean, we don't have any advice to offer you. Peter offers an alternative, taking the anticipated flow of income streams from an asset and discounting them, and that's your mark. Have you given any thought, has Treasury given any thought to this, and have you had any conversations with SEC that you could share with us on stepping back and taking a new look at this accounting practice, which I believe, and many economists believe, is harmful to the long-term goal of getting stability in the financial markets?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. The mark-to-market has received a significant amount of attention lately, and for those of you that don't follow the accounting practices closely, there's a specific set of regulation around how you mark assets in the liquid markets under one of the FASB rules that's been put into effect. And I think our view would have a couple perspectives. First, the accounting, the SEC and others, as you know, are independent regulators. So certainly we have contact on this, but they're the decision makers in terms of how they think about this. Second point, the Secretary has said it publicly, and I think a number of Treasury officials have. The mark-to-market, we think, has challenges associated with it. There's certainly an effort to figure out if there are ways to improve the guidelines around mark-to-market. But the underlying principles of mark-to-market, the need to struggle to find a market price, or in the absence of a market price, a write-down that reflects the best estimate of a market price, is ultimately, challenges notwithstanding, a useful and important thing to do. It's like the Churchill's remarks regarding democracy, it's the worst of all options except for all the others in his reference to democracy. And in this case, to make a change, particularly in a time of uncertainty, creates real problems. And again, the underlying principles we think are important. So there's a lot of focus on this and a lot of questions about whether the mark-to-market methodology can be refined, but I don't think there's a lot of disagreement around the importance of those principles of mark-to-market. Thanks.
Hi there, Christopher Swan from Bloomberg News. I wanted to ask about Freddie and Fannie. I know it's not in your remit, but how big a potential threat might they be to the global economy if their problems deepen?
Well, thanks. I would just... on Freddie and Fannie, just to make several comments that have been made recently. The first is that, as the Secretary said, I think in his remarks yesterday, the benefit and importance of Fannie and Freddie moving forward on their capital raising that they've said they're going to do. And then second, I think what we see in the markets today just emphasized, particularly with regard to Fannie and Freddie, the importance of GSE reform. This is obviously an area that's gotten a lot of attention, and it's something that's being considered in current legislation, and is and remains a real priority for the administration and many in Congress.
Good one, reporter for Voice of America. I have a question. Would you like to share some thoughts of yours about the U.S. dollar? U.S. officials have been talking about strong dollars for years, but the dollar keeps moving lower and lower. And what's the, in your view, what's the long-term and the medium-term trend of the dollar? And are there any specific things the Treasury plan to do to strengthen the dollar? Thank you.
Yeah, why don't you hold the mic, because I'm going to disappoint you here. I'm going to say I would just refer you to the Secretary's recent remarks on the dollar. I think he's commented on it just in the last 24, 48 hours. So he's our main spokesperson on the dollar. But I'm happy to answer another question if you have one.
Thank you for your time this afternoon. Bethany Lurch from OSD Policy. A few months earlier, the New York Times ran an article on the superpower status of the U.S. and specifically in regards to the economy. It also highlighted other countries and other groups of countries, China and the European Union, which are now becoming really vast markets with enormous potential. And I'm wondering what kind of risks or threats or opportunities that these two other entities pose to the U.S. and actions that the Treasury is going to be taking in regards to them.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Well, this is a great question because I often get the question, what do you think about the rise of the emerging economies and the significant role they're playing in global growth? And the way the question is formulated often suggests it's a zero sum. So that growth comes at the expense of our growth or our economic well-being. And I think in many ways it's the opposite. So what we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years, last decade really, is an enormous expansion in the global economy. That expansion in the global economy has been driven in part by the growth and productivity in the United States. By any measure, the United States remains, if you look at underlying fundamentals, one of the most productive, one of the most vibrant, one of the most innovative economies in the world. And Secretary Paulson often says, and I would reiterate, if you could trade our economy with any other major development economy in the world, you wouldn't trade that. Our economy has a resilience and an ability to respond to changes in the market in a way that's unlike any other. But we've also seen growth in other parts of the world, growth in Europe, where many of the European economies, by taking steps towards economic liberalization, by reforming tax policy, have become more competitive. That's a great step because that opens up their markets to the U.S. And the emerging economies, which have grown in some cases at double-digit rates, which has also been a great source of growth and opportunity for us. What that change in the world does do is enhance and highlight the importance of openness. Because if you think about the growth in that global economy, if the United States is not part of that global engagement, if we don't open our markets and in turn be able to engage with those markets and sell into those markets, then we lose an enormous opportunity. And in these very challenging times we've seen in the last 12 months, one of the things that's really stood out has been the health and success of U.S. exports, U.S. export growth, which was healthy even before we've gone through the current challenges, but it's been particularly healthy over the last 12 months. And that's an indication of our competitiveness. And part of the reason those exports have grown is because the emerging markets have continued to grow. They haven't really slowed down much as a result of some of the things that have happened in the United States and Europe. So it's generally a great thing. That doesn't mean we won't have tensions. That doesn't mean we won't have conflict with some of these emerging markets, with Europe. That's part of a mature relationship. And as that relationship grows, there'll be new areas of tension. We'll disagree on poultry and all sorts of other economic issues. But our strengths and our opportunities and our ties will be far greater than our areas of differences in many of those cases. Thanks.
Hi, thank you for your remarks today. Emily Norris, also from OSD Policy. My first question regards, in the beginning of your talk, you mentioned the challenges of global public goods, and under that you talked about rising commodity prices. And I was wondering whether you consider, which commodities you consider global public goods, and what steps should, if any, be taken to counter the rising prices of commodities. And if I may ask a second question, my second question concerns your remarks on using economic strategies to counter funding of terrorists or production of weapons of mass destruction. And I'm wondering, what are the benefits of using the economic strategies versus the more traditional hard power strategies for countering terrorism? And specifically, with regards to the case of Iran, I mean, the United States has had sanctions against that country since 1979, and I'm wondering what the recent steps, why are the recent steps more different, and are they having an effect, and what sort of an effect is that going to have in the long run?
Yeah, thanks. Well, on commodity prices, maybe I could talk for a minute about fuel prices, and I'd be happy to go into food prices if you'd like me to, but that I think, is in front and center for many of us. You know, what we see in fuel prices, in particular oil prices, is unfortunately the byproduct of some very significant underlying shifts in the fundamentals of supply and demand. I wish I could say it was something other than that, because if it was something other than that, it would be easier to address in the near term. But you've seen the supply of oil remain relatively constant. Whatever new capacity has come online has essentially offset declining yields in other production capacity around the world. At a time when you've seen, as a byproduct of that enormous growth in other emerging economies, you've seen the global demand grow. And as the global demand has grown, supplies remain relatively constant, you've seen increasingly tight markets. And those increasingly tight markets have resulted in as classic economics would tell you, a rise in price. I think probably a faster rise in price than many of us would have expected, but a rise in price that's driven by not only the present supply and demand dynamics, but changing expectations around the future supply and the future demand, which is reflected in price as well. So it's a real challenge, and it's not something, unfortunately, that lends itself to near-term solutions. There are some things that we could potentially do on the margin, but ultimately what's going to require is a change on the supply side and a change on the demand side. On the supply side, we're going to need more investment in capacity, more investment in drilling, and more investment in refining capacity, either in the United States or in other countries around the world. 80% of the oil reserves around the world are nationalized. So by creating investment in many of those markets, you'll not only have higher productivity, but you'll have more investment, and ultimately that investment will yield greater production. We also need to have significantly greater investment in alternative fuels. So it's that combination on the supply side that's going to change that trajectory I mentioned. And that doesn't happen in a year. That happens over many years. On the demand side, we need to obviously think about conservation here in the United States and in other places in a much more aggressive and creative way than we have in the past. And we also need to take steps to eliminate subsidies around the world because 60% of the fuel in these emerging economies is subsidized. So the demand profile we see is distorted. It's not a market-driven demand. And so that's the portfolio of things we need to do. And it's not easy, but it's necessary. And it's necessary not only within the context of energy demand, but it's necessary within the context of some of the environmental challenges that I talked about earlier. That was the first question. What was the second question? Terrorist financing. Yeah, so on that, I think what's different is the financial markets and the flow of capital is much more sophisticated. So there is much more openness and ultimately much more fungibility of assets cutting across borders. And I think the bad guys have become much more sophisticated as well, as we saw in the aftermath of 9/11, given some of the things that came out in the 9/11 Commission and other things. So we have a new enemy with new tools at their disposal in the sense that they recognize that ultimately it's going to be dollars or funding that allows these terrorist networks to survive, these weapons programs to survive, and they become very clever at finding ways to finance that from pockets of money around the world designated to these programs. And so we've undertaken a very comprehensive approach, which has been multilateral, because you can't attack a global problem with all these integration of capital markets unilaterally, and one that involves the private sector, because the private sector is absolutely critical to making this effective. And that's the difference. The problem's different. It's broader. It's more sophisticated. It's more challenging. And the response needs to be equally so. Yes?
Do you have time? Yeah. Let's take the two questions right in a row in the back, and then I think.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Great. Hi. I'm Jonathan Robbins of CSIS. I had a question regarding the dollar zone economies. With the combination of rising fuel and food prices and kind of the loose U.S. monetary policy, there's been particular pressure on dollar zone economies, and some people have actually speculated that could lead to the end of the Bretton Woods II regime. Has Treasury heard? I mean, what is Treasury thinking about this, and are there any plans to deal with it?
Just restate the first sentence of your question. The setup was.
Oh, sorry. There's been a lot of talk about the pressure on dollar zone economies from rising food and fuel prices and
the
loose monetary
on
policy.
The dollar.
On pressure on the dollar zone economies, countries that use the dollar are pegged to it.
Yeah. You might want to sit over there with the other guy ask about the dollar. No. The comment here is we don't comment on others' currencies. And as you know, there are a number of currencies around the world that are pegged to the dollar. Our point of view is that different currency regimes may be appropriate for different countries at different times, and that ultimately, given the sensitivity of currency, we don't comment on any specific currencies. So, sorry. If you want to ask another question, I'd be happy to. Okay.
One more question. Hi, Allison Slack, CSIS. I wanted to ask you a question about a recent development in Asia with the Chiang Mai Initiative, where I think 13 Asian economies decided to multilateralize what had previously been bilateral financial swap agreements, the idea being pooling funds for future use against a potential financial crisis like the one that struck that region 10 years ago. 10 years ago, when something similar was proposed, the IMF and the U.S. Treasury were strongly opposed, and I wondered... I haven't heard much from the Treasury, and I wondered if you had views that you could share with us.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I don't think we've said much about it, frankly, and I don't. It hasn't at least been presented to me as a major issue. I mean, one of the things that has been gratifying and I think encouraging is that in the aftermath of the Asian financial crisis, you have seen, with some exceptions, but the general theme I think has been one of financial market reform and liberalization in many of those Asian economies. And that is not the only reason. There's many other reasons. That's not the only reason that they weren't susceptible to some of the challenges that we've seen in the past year or so. But their economies are very robust and much more resilient now than they would have been at that time. And so that's a real success story. One of the things that we fear, one of the things we're worried about, is that some of the challenges we've had here in the U.S. economy, some of the notable and what we've acknowledged is challenges around the opaqueness through securitization and some of the challenges of the credit rating agencies and some of the opaqueness around the off-balance sheet entities. Some of those innovations led to some real uncertainty in our system, and when the repricing of the risk took place that's taken place over the last year, the opaqueness and the uncertainty contributed to some of the responses we've seen in the markets. We're concerned that the wrong lessons from our situation will be learned by some of these Asian economies that have made such progress. And we're afraid that they'll internalize the lesson to be stop reforming, stop liberalizing. And when the lesson should be, we think, much more narrowly defined as the need to address some of these very specific issues associated with the opaqueness and the complacency towards risk that we've seen in our own markets. So that's an ongoing dialogue we're having with many of those countries, and we're hopeful the wrong lessons won't be learned. Thank you.
We are out of time, but thank you. Please join me in thanking the Undersecretary for being here today.